Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Monroe Dodd. As the 1960s turned into the 1970s, we in Kansas City got busy putting up big public buildings. In the space of 4 years, from 1972 to 1976, we opened Kansas City International Airport, the Truman Sports Complex, Bartle Hall, and the big indoor arena called Kemper. It was a stunning public building boom, rivaled only by that one in the 1930s. 4 decades have passed since 1974, when Kemper opened, and we've fixed up the sports complex, added to Bartle, and are vigorously debating the future of KCI. That leaves Kemper. Unlike its contemporaries, it's less used today. On today's show, we'll look back at the origins of our biggest arena and its tumultuous life, highlighted by a national political convention, a Final Four, conference basketball tournaments, professional basketball and hockey teams, rock and roll and country music. Oh, and the spectacular collapse of its roof in a rainstorm one night in 1979. With us today are Bill Haugh, owner of the Livestock Exchange Building and other properties in the West Bottoms, and a large-scale rancher, and Elizabeth Rosen, principal of Rosen Preservation, which consults on historic preservation. Bill and Elizabeth, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
Thanks for inviting us.
This is a great topic today because I have always been curious about the provenance, or whatever you call it, of Kemper Arena. Elizabeth, how did this thing come to pass?
Well, by the mid-20th century, let me backtrack a little bit. At the turn of the 20th century, you start to see a proliferation of indoor sports and entertainment venues across the country. There were new technologies that were making these larger spaces available or buildable. You have the advent of basketball and refrigeration made indoor hockey possible as well. So by the start of World War II, many communities had a venue of some sort, including in Kansas City, Municipal Auditorium. Mm-hmm. After the war, by the late 1950s and early 1960s, there was a need for the economy was booming again. There was a housing boom as well, a population boom. The economy was very vibrant, and there was a desire to create outlets for both excess of leisure time and excess change in one's pocket. And communities across the country started building new, larger sports arenas. And many of them, like Kemper, were very creative. They became symbols of their community and the vibrancy and vitality of their communities.
Kansas City had the Municipal Auditorium, which had housed sporting events for years, but it was just seen as too small or too...
It was too small. It was outdated. Everybody wanted something new. The 60s were all about new. And having a new sports entertainment venue was part of that. And it wasn't just for basketball anymore. Municipal Auditorium worked great for basketball then. It still functions for basketball today. But it wasn't really adaptable for hockey. And there was a strong desire in a segment of the community to bring an NHL expansion team to Kansas City. That was really a booming enterprise. At the same time, the circus was reinventing itself. It was moving from the literal big top to these indoor venues. The ice capades and the ice shows were gaining traction as well. And you needed a different type of facility to handle those.
To put this in a little bit of context, Bill Haugh, Kemper was placed, and we'll talk a little bit about how it got there, but it was placed in the West Bottoms, which had been the economic engine of Kansas City for decades and decades. Isn't that right?
Oh, it absolutely was the economic epicenter for this entire region for many years and was no longer.
And that was because the railroads, the stockyards were down there?
The stockyards were there. It was cattle moving from the west, a logical stopping-off point, really not originally a trading point, as it became, but sort of a resting point to water and feed the cattle before they continued their rail journey onto the east.
And also an apt place there for I suppose, to build these packing houses and things.
It was, and the Kaw River was very conveniently there to dispose of much of the waste that was generated at that time. No longer a popular concept.
Before there was an EPA.
Before.
And there were grain elevators and railroad tracks as far as the eye could see. Old pictures, they're amazing. The smoke from the engines and all that.
it really was sort of a combination of the historic Western opening of the Western United States and the advent of a large farming economy. The river, the railroads, the population center, all of it really mandated Kansas City to become an economic center for agricultural activities.
By the middle of the 20th century, though, the 1940s, 50s, and so forth, about the time these ideas for these big arenas begin springing, the whole West Bottoms is in a bit of decline, isn't it?
Well, our intense interest in the West Bottoms began in 1991 when we bought the then derelict livestock exchange building and the 48 acres surrounding it, and really bought it to some extent. I've always had a deep interest in historic buildings, special historic buildings, and it sort of looked like the livestock exchange would be torn down, which would have been a terrible shame, I think, for the historic roots of Kansas City. So we bought it, and we bought the 48 acres surrounding it, which was then a rat-infested abandoned stockyards, and proceeded to develop that area. An additional incentive was the completion of I-670, which nobody seemed to notice had been one of the dominant factors in purchasing real estate at that time. So we did it, and we're glad, and it's been a lot of fun.
And all those stockyards and all those packing houses moved out to western Kansas and other places, and the decentralization of that industry. And so, Elizabeth, by the time we're talking about the idea of Kemper Arena germinates, it's in the late 60s, it's pretty much a vacant area.
Yes, that was definitely one reason that site was considered. This was one of several sites that were discussed when the idea first came up, including adding this venue out at the Truman Sports Complex. There was a site that was looked at way out south in Johnson County as well. And the question was, which site was going to be able to pool its resources and come up with a financing plan first?
And how did Kansas City do that?
It wasn't the city. It was really a group of individuals who rallied the cause, the folks who wanted to bring this NHL expansion team here and to create this venue. And they developed a fairly complex financing strategy. There was a limited amount, very small amount of financing available through some leftover sports bonds from the 1950s. But other than that, they came up with a strategy of using revenue bonds where they would provide an incentive for individual investors and corporations to seed the project, provide money to seed the project, and that the bonds would be sold from that investment pool. The city ultimately was required to provide a little bit of infrastructure development in terms of roadways and things like that. And then ultimately it was a gift from the Kemper family that made the arena possible.
This was in form of money?
Mm-hmm. It was a $2.5 million financial gift.
Was this old Stockyards Company property that it was built on?
Yes, it was.
How was that transaction arranged? The Stockyards were barely existing at the time.
That's a good question. I believe, and maybe Bill can help answer this as well, I believe it was city property at the time.
Oh, okay.
And that the city was then able to make it available.
So this is a group of people who are basically hockey promoters, National Hockey League. They want that for the town, and that was the first aim of all this.
Yes, it was. It was the linchpin for the pebble that started the whole thing rolling.
And I guess, ironically, as looking back, hockey only lasted here 2 years, and then Kemper's gone on for another 38.
Yeah. Well, there was hockey in several different forms. The Scouts were only here for a couple of years, but then the Blades were here in the 90s, and I think there were the Outlaws after that. And, of course, today we have the Mavericks out in Independence in the newer arena.
In their own arena. So Kemper had to make its way on something other than hockey very early in its career.
Yes.
And that was to get dates set for anything it could find. Is that right?
That's correct. And they did host a wide variety of events, everything from the political convention to the circus and the ice shows to the concerts. And we've talked with so many people over the last 6 months or so as we've been researching Kemper, who have very good memories of shows that they've seen, be it in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, or more recently.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the design of the thing. Interesting exoskeleton, I think it's called.
It's a very unique design, and the communities across the country were trying to create some sort of signature look. And the architects were very excited to utilize some of the new technologies that were becoming available. So this Kemper Arena was designed by a firm, C.F. Murphy and Associates, out of Chicago. They were a very well-known developer of civic projects in the particularly the 50s, the 60s, and into the 70s. They were, at the time, contracted to design Bartle Hall. And there was a young designer on their staff named Helmut Jahn. Mm-hmm. And this ended up being his first design project. He's gone on to have a very illustrious career. He's still designing at in his late 70s today. And the United Airlines terminal at O'Hare Airport is probably one of the designs he's best known for. But there was a very short time frame available for the design process. The financing piece all came together in November of 1972. The city council selected a design team at the end of November of 1972, and they had to have a design ready to present to the National Hockey League ownership group in the middle of January.
Golly.
And so the story is that Helmut Jahn, you know, he really liked structural problems, and it was how do we create this large column-free space, because mm-hmm. that's – you didn't want an arena with columns in the way. That was one of the problems with the older arenas. How do we create this large column-free space, make it efficient to build, efficient to operate, and give it a unique appearance? And he took the major structural elements, kind of put them on steroids, put them on the outside of the building, created this very clean, white, cohesive shell, and then that surrounded the stadium itself, the arena floor, and service areas itself.
And that was before the days of energy drinks, so I suppose he had to drink gallons of coffee to get this thing done in time.
I think he is just one of those people who goes.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Munro Dodd, here with Bill Haw and Elizabeth Rosen. We're talking about Kemper Arena and its four decades in the West Bottoms. Bill, some of this is happening before your investment in the West Bottoms, but what is your understanding from people you know and do business with down there of the impact of Kemper on the West Bottoms in the 70s and 80s and on? Did it have much?
Well, the Kemper did have a considerable emphasis, and particularly during the American Royal at that time. It really was a very vibrant area with long lines out to the street from the various restaurants and bars that were there, and it was quite an exciting time, particularly when the American Royal was in session.
It was tied to the American Royal from the beginning. It was used by the American Royal for part of its events. Is that right?
And in fact, it wasn't just the NHL. The idea of an NHL team was the first thing that sparked the idea of a new arena. But the West Bottoms location really gained traction as a way to support the Royal as well.
Mm-hmm. And so the Royal's bigger things like the concerts, rodeos, and other stuff. And I think the last nights of the horse show and things were held in Kemper. Meanwhile, the Royal had its own building that dated back quite a few decades that's now been replaced but was just
That's correct. The
south of it. Right. Okay. And so there's Kemper down there, and it's creating some vibrancy. I recall it even had a restaurant called the Cordon Bleu in the bottom of it. I don't think there's been a restaurant in it for a long time, though.
The space is still there.
So it's the American Royal is now part of the equation along with the Hockey League, and then there came the NBA. An NBA team. Was this just a tag along, or was it?
I think you know. Once we build it, who will come, but what other regular revenue streams can we identify? And so, having Kansas City being such a huge basketball town, that was the obvious next regular user to identify.
And so came the Kansas City Kings.
Yes.
With a whole panoply of investors in that. And it and the Kings played there and were doing rather well, as I recall, until 1979, when one night in June came a huge rainstorm. Tell us what happened to the roof of the Kemper Arena that night.
Well, that was actually a couple years earlier. It was 1976. It wasn't even that late.
That the storm happened?
Yes.
Oh, really? Okay.
And in fact, the American Institute of Architects were having their national convention in Kansas City, and Kemper's architect, Helmut Jahn, was in town to receive an award for another project. So it's a night in June. There's this crazy thunderstorm with very high winds and a lot of rain. And the manager of the Kemper Arena and some of the maintenance staff noticed water starting to come down next to the scoreboard that hung over the center of the floor. They were able to get out of the way in time, but the scoreboard came down along with a section of the roof. And
there's not a column in sight. That was
there's
the point
not
of the
a
thing.
Column in sight. And immediately the city brought in a forensic investigator to look at the structural issues. They figured out that the problem was there were a couple things. It was an installation issue, that some of the bolts may not have been tightened fully, but also that there was some movement, unanticipated movement that created some shear, and they designed some fixes to that solution to prevent the problem from happening again. The roof was also designed so that it drained toward the center of the building rather than out. So there was an internal drain system, but the water pooled towards the center. And again, all of that weight and if there was additional movement with the water created additional pressure on the roof system.
This had to do with the low-lying nature of the West Bottoms and the water table. It's difficult to discharge.
I don't know what the root of that design was.
Who was managing Kemper Arena at that time?
I believe it was the city.
City of Kansas City through its department that was managing other things like that.
I believe so.
Okay. And that was the manager for a long time until finally private management was brought in. Isn't that right?
No, I don't think so. I think the city has continued to own the Kemper Arena and manage it. The American Royal, and certainly in recent years, has had the right to use it for 20 days out of the year, but the city maintained control of the building and the management of the building.
That might have been just recently when AEG was brought in to manage Sprint that they were allowed to give direction for Kemper as well.
Usually when building collapses occur like that on major scale, they're noticed around the country. Did this have an effect on architecture or engineering practices?
I'm sure it did. I don't know to what extent. It was within a year after the Hartford Civic Center experienced a similar collapse. Theirs was a snow-covered roof that collapsed. And after that incident happened, Kemper Arena and arenas around the country were double-checking their structural systems to make sure that they were solid in the event of a similar situation. And ironically, this happened very shortly thereafter.
Hmm. Bill Hall, over the years, I remember reading over and over again complaints from people that Kemper was in a dark and lonely spot and inaccessible. Now, I know some of those were exaggerated because people talk. But was that its essential problem, that it was a ways away from other stuff?
It was essentially a problem with the Kemper. I remember very well when Mary Hunkler was president of the American Royal, she commented that, and this was before we owned the Stockyards area, that if she couldn't park adjacent to the American Royal facilities, she went on home instead of going. So, the city really didn't follow through with any development adjacent to the Kemper, and because the Stockyards had ceased to exist, really, it was a pretty threatening environment that surrounded the Kemper Arena. I'm awed by Elizabeth's the depth of her knowledge of all this history about it. I will correct one very minor thing. I believe the Stockyards Company did sell the land to the city for the building of it. And, of course, Jay Dillingham, then the president, was immediately besieged by other Stockyards Company's stockholders that he had sold it too cheap. So a very minor correction, I might say.
Now, guys, Kemper Arena has seen a lot of stuff over time. And not long ago, the Republican Party committee was here to look at Kansas City as a convention site, and it was brought up back in 76 it was here, and it was in Kemper Arena. Remind us of some of the other things that people remember and what's been going on there.
The list is very long. I think one of the biggest is probably the Big 12 basketball tournament. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was the impetus for the expansion that happened in the 1990s, to add the additional seating. The number of concerts that people remember, the list is very long. The Willie Nelson, Prince, Michael Jackson, the list goes on and on. I was speaking with somebody recently who had been up in Fort Leavenworth in the late 70s, and somebody who's not a fan of modern architecture, but I love that building, because he had a particular memory of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, maybe Eagles, some concert that he had gone to back then.
I always stand correctable, but I think even Elvis Presley did a concert there, the King. And there was the NBA Kings. And for quite a few years, there was a very popular indoor soccer team called the Comets. It was all the rage for a while.
And they're still in town. I'm not sure where they play, if they play at Sprint Arena these days.
But they were filling Kemper Arena, I recall. You mentioned along the way there was an expansion in 1996. But before the expansion, Kemper Arena was bigger, I think, seated more people than Sprint Center does now. After the expansion, it had 3,000 or 4,000 seats?
Not even that. I think it was about 1,500 to 2,000.
And a big glass wall was put on one side. And so this was to accommodate larger crowds for the Big 12 tournament?
Yeah, and another thing they did was they created an entry directly from the parking level. Mm-hmm. When the building first opened, it sits on that berm, and you would walk up one of four big ceremonial stairways in the corners of the berm, and you would go to one of the four entrances. By creating the new entrance at the parking level one, it made it a little bit more ADA compliant. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to walk up the steps to go into the building. But it also helped funnel the traffic, and I think there might have been a security reason for that as well.
So this addition came in the late 1990s, and by 2001, the city was starting to consider building a whole new Sprint Center up on the hill. Bill Haw, how did this strike you?
Well, obviously, in retrospect, it was a major mistake, and it has detracted somewhat from the architectural significance of the building, although I think the external skeleton and structural support is really the key element. I will say that every morning when I come to the West Bottoms, the Stockyards District, either down 12th Street or coming up on 23rd Street, it's an iconic structure that's, in my mind, second only to the Livestock Exchange.
Yes.
As the iconic identification of that Stockyards District. Another thing I might add, Elizabeth, is in addition to the big-name entertainment that came to the Kemper Arena, which, of course, many people remember in the basketball and the ice hockey and the other things, the American Royal was very spectator-centric during those earlier years. And it really did create a festival atmosphere in the West Bottoms at that time. They subsequently made what was probably a good economic decision for the American Royal, which was to focus on exhibitors and really recognize the fact that they couldn't afford to encourage spectators, what they called butts in the seats at the time. And so the excitement that was generated by the Royal was diminished exponentially at that point. Again, a decision that they made internally that was probably a good decision for the Royal, not a good decision for the neighborhood.
hindsight is always 20/20, isn't it, for us?
Otherwise, they'd have not built the glass in addition to the Kemper.
And you mentioned that as a mistake because there was a lot of money and effort poured into that for a building that will soon not even house that tournament.
It really was, with only a nominal increase in the seating, as Elizabeth pointed out.
Was it an architectural mistake in your mind, Elizabeth? Did it take away from the building?
I wouldn't say it was an architectural mistake. But when you're looking at the architectural integrity and the historical significance of the building, it makes some of those arguments harder to craft.
A lot went on at Kemper Arena over the years, and surely you were there for some concert, sporting event, or other event that you remember. When we come back, we'll ask you to give us a call at 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCURCST. After the short break, we'll continue our conversation with Bill Haw, Sr., and Elizabeth Rosen on the history of Kemper Arena. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Monroe Dodd. With us today is Bill Haw, who has redeveloped the Livestock Exchange building and in the West Bottoms over the last 20 years, owns other properties, and is a large-scale cattle rancher. And also Elizabeth Rosen, an authority on historic preservation. We're talking about the story of Kemper Arena. And if you want to join us and tell us your favorite memories of Kemper Arena, you can. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us. Our handle is KCURCST. Elizabeth Rosen, looking back, what was Kemper's finest hour?
It's hard to say. I think it's had many of them. You don't want to say the day it opened, that hopefully it gained something beyond that. I think architecturally the day it opened and it was this gleaming white edifice, a piece of sculpture in the West Bottoms, was certainly a key day. It might have been the Republican convention. That was a big moment for Kansas City. Bob Dole was nominated as vice president, or native son, and that might have been one of the peak times.
And it was the last convention wherein the stuff at the convention actually made a difference toward the nomination. It wasn't just big march to the nomination. Well, we have some callers. Let's go to Gerald now in Southeast Kansas City. Good morning, Gerald.
Yeah, my memories about Kemper Arena were the Kansas City Kings that had the most impact on me. I would go down there and collect autographs from the home players and opposing players. And it did a lot for me as far as creating a sense of independence. I would get out of school and go straight, sometimes to the arena or to the Crown Center where the opposing teams would be and collect their autographs and then follow them to the arena.
Those were the days. The NBA wasn't quite as big then as it is now, but the Kings being here made a big difference to living in Kansas City, didn't it?
Correct. Missed them. I think when they were leaving was when I really, got a good feel for the NBA. I think Dr. J was on his farewell tour in the last year of the arena, and then Magic Johnson was coming into the NBA. So, yeah, those were some great times.
Yeah,
great
I think maybe Michael Jordan played 1 year when the Kings were still in town.
I believe so, but he was nowhere near the star that he turned out to be. And I don't believe anybody had any idea that he would become so big.
Well, it was great that you got to see all that. Gerald, thank you so much for your call this morning.
Thank you.
And now let's go to Vernon in Liberty. Good morning, Vernon. Welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
And what's your question or comment?
I'm an architect, and I have a better understanding of the failure of the roof collapse, if you're interested in hearing it. The problem resulted mainly from the large 12-inch round main drain standpipe that collected water from close to the center of the roof and drained it on down to the existing storm drainage system that the city supported in the streets. And at that time, and I don't know if it's been changed since, but the the sewer, sanitary sewer, and the storm sewer were combined into one large drainage system. And the problem occurred as a result of the water coming from the huge roof of the camper would fill that 12-inch round downspout or roof drain, to the point that it created an enormous pressure in the piping of the storm drainage system. In fact, it created such an enormous pressure that it shot the manholes up in the street up, I've heard, as much as 10 or 12 feet or more. So the correction that the city instituted, and incidentally, the architect had nothing to do with it, but the city on its own solved the problem by placing smaller roof drains over the larger down down drain. So while it was a 12-inch down drain, they only had a 6 or 8-inch roof drain to stop the water from coming in so full. Therefore, the standpipe would not be completely full, and it would no longer pressurize the storm drain in the streets, and the manholes would not be shot up. Now, the problem was that since it had this restriction on the roof drain, the roof began to pond and collect more water. And consequently, as it collected more water, it began to depress that big triangular truss system. On one edge of the truss was supporting a series of girders that supported the joist, the bar joist, and therefore, with a little bit of deflection, more water would come in, and the pond got bigger and bigger. So more pond, more water, more deflection, then more water, and so forth. So it kept getting more and more water until finally it was such a overloaded connection there, and connecting to the truss, that the bolt broke, and then the rest is history.
Okay, Vernon, thank you very much for calling us today with that bit of information. Elizabeth Rosen, do you have any reaction?
I know that is that the ponding of the water was definitely part of the problem. I know that the structural engineer and the forensic investigation also discovered some other issues as well. So it was like most of these situations, it was multi-pronged.
Speaking of favorite memories, we have Dale from Kansas City on the line. Dale, good morning, and welcome to Central Standard.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me.
What are your memories of Kemper?
Well, it was such a great concert venue at the time. It was a, you know, new, like you said, a shiny white beacon down there in the West Bottoms. But my memory most stands out the most to me was the night that Ted Nugent had a concert there. And he was in his white leotard that he had, playing his white Gibson Birdland guitar. And somebody in the audience threw a ball bearing, hit him in the front teeth, broke his teeth out, blood all over the place. And he tried to play a little bit longer, but the pain was too much for him to bear. And he stopped his concert, and he vowed never to come back to Kansas City again because of that little incident. Of course, he's been back many times since then, but it was it was quite a long time ago, but that was just one of the most striking memories I have of the Kemper Arena. And along with many other good memories of some great concerts, like the Police were there, and a number of really good groups, though. It was such a great concert venue at the time. You know, now it's now I'm sure it's a little more antiquated than the Sprint Arena and whatnot. But yeah, that was something I'll never forget that. It was incredible. I was sitting right on the side and had a vantage view of everything that was going on behind the stage. They were looking at him, rubber gloves and white gauze and pen lights and everything, trying to figure out what was going on. And but yeah, that was a real shocking moment.
So Dale, what year did this happy welcome to Kansas City for Ted Nugent occur?
It had to have been in the 80s.
Okay.
Might have been in the late 70s, but the early 80s or late 70s. And it was on the national news. It was on network news that like the next night. I remember seeing it on ABC or something. They talked about it. But Yeah, quite an incident.
All right, Bill. Thanks very much.
And the fact that the Kansas City Kings left town because the roof wasn't repaired in time for the stay here. I remember that. But anyway, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Let's go now to Josie in Carthage. Josie,
Hi.
Good morning.
How are you?
Just fine. What's your memory?
Well, I have a concert story, too. Didn't hit national news, I don't think. But 1987, U2, Joshua Tree tour. I was in eighth grade, and my mother let me and my younger brother and friend camp out for tickets the night before they went on sale, back when you could do that. And we had a sleeping bag, a bag of Doritos, a boombox, and the line wrapped entirely around Kemper Arena on the sidewalk, that abutted the parking lot. And then at about 8 o'clock in the morning, they gave us a signal, and we all stood up, gathered our things, and, condensed the line to actually buy tickets. And that experience was almost as fun as the concert a few months later. Because, it was like this hippie experience, and I was 13, everyone sharing food and playing different U2 albums. And just getting excited for the show.
I take it you weren't in line in the dead of winter.
No, we weren't. I think it was a fall sometime. But my parents just dropped us off in the parking lot and said, see you in the morning, and brought us donuts and chocolate milk the next morning, and totally encouraged that experience. It was wonderful.
Very good. Thanks for sharing that, Josie.
Yeah. Take care.
We have Nick from Waldo who called to say, could the money be used to build the Sprint Center? Could have been used to build up Kemper and install a light rail connection between downtown and the West Bottoms. Somebody else said, could it be used to revitalize other areas? What about that money? I mean, that's an age-old question. If you can send a man to the moon, why can't you solve hunger and stuff? What are your guys' reaction to the money used on the Sprint Center?
Well, again, it's another example of second-guessing decisions that might have seemed good at the time and didn't later. I think it's heartwarming to hear some of the comments about memories of the Kemper Arena. And my own thought is it's a terrible shame to tear down iconic structures that engender those sort of memories. So, the comments I hear about the Kemper is, gee, it's not as nice in many ways as the Sprint Center, but as a place to view an athletic event or a concert, it may even have some advantages. And the key element right now, I think, is not to worry about the money that might have been misspent in the past, but what's the best path forward for it. And, we have an alternative use. Obviously, it can't be resurrected in the same context that it was before because of the Sprint Arena and the fact that AEG has an extremely restrictive clause in their contract that there just can't be the big name entertainment or sports things in the Kemper anymore. But I think the challenge is going to be to figure out how can we repurpose it so that going forward it has a different mission. And, of course, I, to some extent selfishly, would love to see repurposing that would result in a steady stream of activity for the sake of the neighborhood.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Before we continue on that line, let's go to one of the guys who has a question, and it's one that hasn't come up in our conversation today. John in Lexington, you had a question about the Kemper Arena.
Yes, I'm an FFA here in Lexington, and I know when the National FFA Convention left Kansas City, we always planned on attending the convention and then going to the American Royal. There was a lot of kids and parents and teachers that went. How did that affect? It seemed like when that happened, the American Royal seemed to start into its decline. And I'll get off the air for your response.
Thanks, John. What about the departure of the FFA, excuse me, late 90s, I believe?
The departure of the FFA was a signal event, really, for the American Royal and for the Kemper Arena and for the neighborhood. But it was really only one of many things that happened. I think the really seminal change was when the American Royal decided to not try to appeal to spectators by having big name events there in conjunction with the agricultural events. And that's what really really sort of disconnected the American Royale from the spectator aspect of it.
Now, one of the biggest events of the American Royale is the barbecue.
The barbecue is an absolute spectacular Friday night festival event. It, to the extent that it virtually shuts down everything else that might be occurring at that time. So, yeah, I think Kansas City's identification with the American Royale has become an identity based on the barbecue, and it is a spectacular festival event.
So let's go back just a second to this, to where we are with the Kemper Arena now. I know both of you have been involved in the question, and I think you'll be willing to say that you're on the side of preserving the Kemper Arena. But the question is out there because a proposal has been made by the American Royale to demolish the thing and replace it with a smaller structure. Now, for full disclosure here, we did ask the American Royale to send a representative today, and they were unable to do that. And so we just have the side of preservation here with us. But what and I know you would where do you guys tell us why your stand is what it is on the preserving the Kemper?
Preservation isn't just about history. It's also about sustainability. And so from my perspective, Kemper Arena is still very viable. I think, as Bill said, it's fully functional inside. It can still completely do the job for which it was designed, or some adaptation of that, some variation of that. There's a lot of infrastructure already in place. There's a lot of energy that went into harvesting and producing materials to build it, that went into building it, that have gone into operating it so far. And if you tear it down, you're just putting all of that in the landfill. And that seems to be a waste. That careful consideration should be given to other uses for the center.
Bill Haw?
I agree absolutely with what Elizabeth said about the sustainability issues on it. But I think more importantly in my mind is the fact that the American Royale could easily build the facility they want to build if the city is willing to support it to $50 million on the same site. Because of the absence of spectators and the fact I've never seen all of the parking fully utilized there now, I would love to see the two entities coexist. The Kemper Arena in a new iteration going forward, and I love the idea of it being based on youth sports, and the American Royale side by side to, in a much smaller venue, continue to operate it as they have historically.
That's the proposal by a company called Fouch to make it a youth sports useful for that.
Yes, it is. And they believe they could bring 1,000 young participants a day on a continuing basis there. And then by installing a floor between the first and second level, they'd end up with 12 basketball courts. So you could not only fill a tremendous need for practice space in youth sports, but regional tournaments that wouldn't have to jump from one school to another back and forth, but could play the entire tournament in one spot. But again, not to the exclusion of the American Royale, but to coexist side by side at no additional cost to the city just seems like a no-brainer to me.
Right now, the American Royale is the leaser of the Kemper Arena. It has a lease that extends till 2045, is it, with the city?
Well, technically, it isn't a lease. They have the right to use it. They have a lease on the American Royale complex. Mm-hmm. But the Kemper Arena is specifically differentiated in that, and the Royal has the right to use it 20 days of the year, and I might say for the mutual benefit of the city and the American Royal, because the attendance is down to a few hundred paid admissions, there's some question about whether or not it is to the mutual benefit of the city.
And you said AEG has a clause in its contract on Sprint that prohibits big acts from appearing at Kemper. Is that right?
I think more specifically, the city is required to refer every inquiry that they have to the Sprint Arena, who gets first shot at it. And so far, they've chosen to do most of the things.
I see. Okay. On Twitter, a person whose handle is Casey Tomato writes that Pink Floyd and the Animals was his favorite memory of a touring concert. Can't recall if it was 77 or 78. Probably the best overall stage performance he's ever witnessed. Was Kemper good as a music venue?
I never saw a concert there myself, but I've always heard it was fantastic. That there were no columns to obstruct your view. The design was very flexible to maximize seating and proximity to a stage, no matter how you wanted that stage set up. So it was definitely designed with multiple uses in mind and flexibility for concerts as well as the athletic events.
And promoters and the acts liked it. They were okay with it.
As far as I know, yes.
Because there were complaints starting at some point in the 1990s that Kemper was I'll use the D word, dump, D-U-M-P, which I don't know. That was in the eye of the beholder, I guess. But it was thought that it was run down and things.
Maintenance is always an issue with any building. And by the mid-90s, you were starting to see the next generation of arenas and entertainment venues being built across the country. So the venues that were built in the late 50s and early 1960s to the early 1970s were beginning to be replaced. And so all of a sudden you have a shiny new venue in one town, and then you come to Kemper Arena, which is starting to show a little bit of its age. And that happens with all buildings.
Yeah.
It maybe did not have all of the amenities or all of the features that some promoters were looking for. When it was built in 1974, it was one of the first arenas to have private boxes. And there were 24 or 25 private boxes that ring the upper level of the lower concourse or the lower seating tier, which was phenomenal at the time. Today, they're considered woefully inadequate compared to the modern standard of a private box.
Because there's been it's sort of like the nuclear arms race in terms of prettifying and making great boxes to lure people to spend even more money on the thing. Where all this stands today, the question of what to do with Kemper Arena, is being studied by a city council committee right now. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. I think three council people have been appointed to study the issue and come closer to having a decision on really the two conflicting proposals before them.
So maybe sometime this year, that committee will recommend something to the full council.
I believe that's true.
And it's the full council's final decision, is that correct?
I believe it's the full council's decision, subject to the recommendations, to some extent, of the committee.
So we will see what happens on that. Kathy, by the way, emailed us her favorite memory of the Kemper. I took my mom to see Old Blue Eyes, that would be Frank Sinatra, in the 1980s. When we sat down, I explained that you can only see a man like that if you're properly prepared. I'd sneaked in a bottle of wine and some plastic wine glasses. Perfection. Bill Haw, how would you describe the status of the West Bottoms these days? You have a great interest in it, I know, and you're probably optimistic about it, but what do you say about it?
Well, I'm of course, going to reply in a completely unbiased manner. Both the mayor and the city manager and a lot of other people have commented that it's obviously going to be the next big thing in Kansas City, and I couldn't agree more. We have brought 1,000 or so, maybe 1,500 or more new employees into the area with the Missouri Unemployment Department and with Butler Manufacturing's headquarters. And our own building is nearing 100% occupancy, well over 300 people in the building. The Telegram building's fully occupied. The Genesee Royale and Voltaire are two very successful restaurants drawing people from all over the metropolitan area, really. So I, I agree with this whole idea of the next big thing.
Hmm. It's also developing something of an arts community, isn't it?
You know, one of the best things I did when we restored the Livestock Exchange building was I kept the entire fifth floor undeveloped so that we'd have affordable studios for artists. We now have, I think, 38 artist studios in the building and a waiting list, always a waiting list for more. So they're a relatively small percentage of the total building, but a very important part of the culture that we have going in the building.
Kemper Arena is past, and it's maybe a little bit of an idea of what its future might be. That's all the time we have for today. I want to really thank Elizabeth Rosen, historical preservationist, and Bill Haw, the owner of the Livestock Exchange building and a large-scale rancher, for joining us. Thank you both.
Our pleasure.
You can listen to this program again, subscribe to our podcast, or listen to any of our previous programs at kcur.org/centralstandard. Join us again on Monday at 10 as we introduce you to a KU professor who's transforming the language of Kazakhstan and take you to a town in Missouri where the last of French dialect is about to disappear. Up to Date is just a minute away. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, and our announcer is Linda Scher. I'm Monroe Dodd, and this is KUCUR.